So welcome everyone to our Kol El Arim Veleya of Angels and Men. This is from the Parsha past, Vayishlach. So the first words of the Torah reading of this past Saturday says, Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefanav. And Jacob sent angels in front of him. El Esav Achiv, to Esau his brother, Artsa Seir, to the land of Seir, Stay Edom, the field of Edom, which is the ancestral homeland of Esau and his progeny. Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim, he sent angels. Now, it is commonly not translated as angels, because the word malach, angel, which we're going to really go into in depth tonight, is synonymous with the Hebrew word shaliach, a messenger, an emissary, a glorified FedEx guy. So this word malachim could mean he sent emissaries, but the rabbis have a little midrashic insight, a little oral insight, and they say that no. Jacob actually sent real angels. Why? Because no right-thinking Jew, member of Jacob's entourage, would ever volunteer willingly to go to Esau, who was the most nefarious character and posed a real, clear, and present danger to everyone. And so consequently, Jacob was forced to empower the malachim, the real angels, because no one else would be dispatched to seek out Esau, because, you know, like, you know, they talk about Caesar, when somebody would deliver a bad message, you don't shoot the messenger. Esau had a tendency to shoot the messengers. So it wasn't a job with retirement benefits. So it was necessary for him to send angels. Now, why is it germane whether the word angel means a messenger? Because ultimately, an angel, for whatever it means or does not mean, is an emissary of God. A malach Hashem, an angel of God. We welcome the angels, even you welcome angels to your home, perhaps on Friday nights, when you sing Shalom Aleichem Malachei Hasharet. You welcome the angels of God into your home every Shabbat, whatever that means. Now, I know in other religions, especially Christologically, angels are really big. The depiction of angels and how people see angels, it's a very big thing. In Judaism, we kind of just gloss over it. We talk about angels appearing here or there, but we really don't have a concept of what an angel could mean. So I'd like to sort of demystify a little bit tonight, through the prism of our Parsha, what an angel is, perhaps, in Judaism, what an angel is not, and more specifically, what it means for us. So let's look at source number two. This is a very, very famous sequence of verses. This is from our Parsha past, Genesis 32. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. So just stop there for 1 second. It's a mysterious verse. Did you catch the contradiction? Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with... Well, if he was alone, how could he have wrestled with anyone? The whole idea of him being alone tells us there's no human being. So perhaps that's a source for the rabbis extrapolating that maybe it wasn't a flesh and blood man who wrestled with him. So that's one of the thoughts of otherwise that verse doesn't really make a lot of sense. The next verse, when he, this unidentified man, saw that he could not prevail against him, Jacob, we're filling in the pronouns now. When the man could not prevail against Jacob, he, lots of pronouns, the man touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip became dislocated as he wrestled with him. Let's just stop for 1 second. So unfortunately, tragically, for those who are steak lovers, this last verse ruined your life, because this is the reason that we as Jewish people have a tradition in America, but not in Israel, good news, that we don't eat the tenderloin area of the cow. It is entirely kosher in theory. However, the sciatic nerve, what we call in Hebrew the gid hanasha, runs right through that sirloin steak, porterhouse, New York cut, filet mignon, you know, all those really nice steaks. They're all from that loin area of the cow. And therefore, in America, our tradition is after we shecht, we ritually slaughter the cow, we simply give that away to the non-Jewish people to use in their outback steakhouses. But that in Israel, where meat is a premium, they import their meat, because if you look at a little map of Israel, there's not a lot of like pastoral lands that you can pasture sheep and goats, and especially big behemoth, big animals like cows. They just don't exist. So they import most of their meat from a place called Argentina. So don't cry for her, because she sends the meat over to Israel. Now, because the meat is bought, they have a mesorah, a tradition, that they do what's called treberin. And they take, with a very careful knife, they have an expert, and they will carve out the gid anasha from the loin section. So in Israel, you can go to a kosher steakhouse. I haven't had one, but this is what I've heard. You go to a kosher steakhouse in Israel, and you can have like a filet mignon or a New York cut. Now, it's going to be a holy snake, because it's holy because it's going to have a hole in it, because he'll have cut out the gid anasha, the sciatic nerve. There was a place in New York recently, I'm not sure if they still in business, a kosher place, who were also treberin the meat. And the problem was that it's really more for Sephardic Jews have a tradition to eat meat that has had the sciatic nerve cut out, whereas Ashkenazic Jews do not have that tradition. So the question arose, was it okay, even in absence of the gid anasha, the sciatic nerve, would a non-Sephardic Jewish person be allowed to eat that meat? So again, it's a question for the rabbis. But be that as it may, poor Yaakov was damaged. The man tried to injure him, and he damaged his sciatic nerve. And any of you, God forbid, who have back problems probably know that the root of most back pain is that sciatic nerve and that little area by the hip that, right? I mean, Doc, isn't that true? Isn't that like the source for a lot of people's pains, yep, right? There wouldn't be a chiropractic business today without that sciatic nerve, right? The nerve of them. Exactly. Okay, third verse. And he, now we get a pronoun filled in. The angel said, or the man, let me go, for dawn is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you have blessed me. So the man, the angel said to Jacob, what is your name? You would think at this point, if he came from heaven to wrestle and destroy him, he might know his target, but apparently not. He said, my name is Jacob. And he, the man, said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, because you have commanding power with an angel of God and with men, and you have prevailed. Vatuchal. And Jacob asked and said to the angel, now tell me your name. And he, the angel, said, this is the way you answer a question with a question. Why is it that you ask for my name? And he, the angel, blessed him there. End of the story. So let's unpackage this, shall we? Okay. Here is the context. What was Jacob doing alone? That's very germane to the story. So Jacob heard that dear brother Esau is coming. Va'arba me'ot ish imo. With 400 chieftains with him. Military warriors. And he's getting that message from these dispatched messengers from the first verse that he sent. They come back, they say, good news, Esau's coming to meet you. Bad news, 400 men are coming with them, men of renown. In other words, not just soldiers, but warriors. John Wick and 399 other John Wicks. They're on their way. So obviously this is not a good thing if you're Jacob. So Jacob took preparations. He did three things to get ready for his fatal meeting with Esau. That could be fatal for one of them. Who knows? So what did he do? He divided his family up into two parts to take military preparedness. So he divides his family into two. He thinks to himself, if one of my family, God forbid, is attacked, Esau's not going to know if that's my entire family or just, he doesn't know, how many kids I have? I have 12, right? Remember, Benjamin had been born. So he has 12 children, and, you know, who knows? In fact, Benjamin's not. Rachel's pregnant with Benjamin, so I'm sorry about it. 11 kids. He doesn't know, so I'm going to cut my family into half. 6 and 5 of the children and the moms and everybody and the livestock. And if, God forbid, the intent of Esau is nefarious, then at least v'hanishar lifleita, the other remaining part of my camp, they'll survive. I'll have survivors in my camp. So he prepares for battle. And then he, of course, does what we always do up against adversaries. We've done this historically ever since Jacob taught us. You bribe the bad guys. And this is not a small issue. Okay, I'll explain in a moment. He sent 550 animals, real stock portfolio. And he told his messengers, when you deliver the gifts, don't just deliver them in one fell swoop, 550. No. Revach tasimu ben eder le'eder. Put a revach, a space. So spatially, it's sort of like getting your birthday gift 7 days of your birthday. Each day you get another package. Rather than just giving you seven gifts in one fell swoop, which is great, each day I schlep out another gift. So poor Esau, who loved gifts, he was a very gift-oriented, greedy guy. Jacob knew the heart of his brother. I mean, they're twins. So he tells them, you know what? Every half hour, every 45 minutes, Jacob will look up and see another group on the horizon coming. He'll say, well, what is this? Oh, that's another gift from Jacob. And then half hour, 45 minutes pass, another group arrives with another group of gifts. So it will satiate, hopefully, the gluttony and the desire that Esau has for to be buttered up. So he sends him a mincha, sends him an offering, but designed to buy off Esau. And it really became a historical thing. You might say, how do we see this? Because all throughout history, the Jewish people, when wherever we're in the exile, that is Esau's exile. Now, you might say, well, what is Esau's exile? I'm glad you asked. You see, Edom is the nation of Esau. Edom has a lot of progeny. The most famous children that came from him are the Romans, the Roman Empire. We are currently in the exile of Rome. Why? Because they destroyed our Beit HaMikdash. They exiled us from Israel. They're the ones who renamed Israel Palestine. Didn't come from any Arabs that we know of. It came from the Romans as a shtuch, as a way of getting under our skin. Because who are the enemies of the Jews always in the Philistines? Thank you, Carolyn. The Plishtim, the Palestinian, the original Plishtim, which were a seafaring people, plagued us, just ask poor Samson, right, or King David. For many generations, the Philistines were bad. So in order to shtuch the Jews, the Romans took away our name Israel and called it Palestine. So the original Palestinians were Jewish people. Okay, just as a little side light there. All right, getting back to our narrative then. So for 2,000 years since the destruction of the temple in the year 70, we are in Galus Edom, the exile of the Edomites, of the Romans. That means whatever Edom means, that's how you deal with them. So for 26 years, the rabbis were able to appease the original Romans. They made peace treaties, they kept their word, they kind of probably gently filled in their Cayman Island bank accounts with some extra shekels or lira, whatever the Roman coin was. Things were okay for a while. And then, of course, it flipped on a dime and it did not end up in a good place. So over the millennia, Jewish people have always used a little bit of bribes, shall we say, just like a nice little incentive to sort of stave off the worst of the worst. It came in a very tragic, horrific end, though, in Europe. Because for many, many generations, we had always been able to pay off the bad guys, whether it was the czars and all the people who were inflicting maximum damage and pain on the Jewish people in Europe. We always had wealthy Jewish families, Baruch Hashem, thank God, who were smart. And they knew who to give the incentives to. And you may have heard about this. But when it came to one specific group, the Nazis, you couldn't buy them off. And tragically, most tragic event perhaps of the whole Holocaust is what happened to the Hungarian Jewish community. Because they really perished at the end of the Holocaust, the end of the war. And they were not persecuted till about 1943-ish and beyond. And they still believe, because they were the wealthiest per capita of the Jewish communities, they still believe that the money that they would have would protect them from the Nazis. And they underestimated one thing. That you see, Esau, he can be bribed. But the toxicity of the Nazis wasn't just Esau's children. You see, it came through his son Eliphaz, and it came from this radical woman named Timna. And Timna was so radicalized, she was so hell-bent on joining the Jewish people and becoming somehow spiritual, that the amalgam of the Esau hatred of Jacob with the toxicity and fanaticism of this woman, Timna, created the biblical man known as Amalek. And Amalek can't be bought. No matter how much money you give Amalek, it's not going to make a difference. In fact, au contraire, and we're not going to go there tonight, it's a whole separate class, they will pay for the right to exterminate the Jews. You know how I can prove that to you? Haman. They tried to buy off Haman. He can't be bought. In fact, Haman goes to the king, "Your Royal Highness, I'll give you $400 million of shekels. I want to own the Jews and I can destroy the Jews." Haman was willing to pay all of his Swiss bank accounts to Ahasuerus for the privilege of murdering the Jews. So it's literally the opposite. So again, it's just a historical fact. And you see that Jacob used this tactic right now in order to appease Big Brother. So we had the military breaking up with the family. And then you have, of course, the mincha. He's giving him tons of gifts. And of course, the most important of all, as a Jew, Hakol Kol Yaakov, he's busy praying and davening to God to please save the day. So he was prepared in three different ways for this faithful meeting. And what happens? After he went across this little river, Jacob remembers, "Oh my gosh, I forgot certain things on the other side of the river." And so he leaves the protection of his family. And he goes back across this little place called the Yabok. And it is back across the river that the man in the evening discovers a bereft Jacob. He's alone. He doesn't have family. He doesn't have the protection of the numbers. And the man tries to destroy Jacob and they fight the whole evening. That's sort of the context of what happened. But why did Jacob expose himself? Why did he go back? So the rabbis say something a little weird. They say he had forgotten some little knickknacks, some pachim ketanim, some little jars, some containers, some keepsakes. So he risks his life and exposes himself to attack, and he almost died, over some knickknacks that weren't consequential enough to remember during his first trips over the water when it was daylight and his family was with him. So it's kind of strange. The rabbis make a big deal. Oh, you see, the great tzaddikim, great righteous people value even the little trinkets in life. Well, I'm not allowed to put my life on the line for a trinket. You know, it's like Henny Youngman or Jack Benny, right? Your money or your life. At least the money should be consequential. It shouldn't be your penny or your life. You know, come up with a number at least to make it not such a joke. But why would Jacob expose himself? So we have to try to figure this out. What does that mean? Okay. So now let us go on in that conversation that we had in number two. Okay. So Jacob is found by this individual. Let's call him the angel. The angel tries to destroy Jacob. They wrestle, they fight. He damages his sciatic nerve area, the Gedanasha. And then Jacob doesn't give up. He's unrelenting. And he says to the angel, "I win. You have to stay with me." And the angel says, no, I got to go. Dawn is breaking. "I have to go," he says. I need to go back to heaven where I came from. You have to let me know. Jacob says, "Fine, I'll let you know. You can go. Providing you give me a bracha, I want a blessing." "What's your name?" "Jacob." "So no longer will you be known as Jacob," which has connotations of nefarious, duplicitous action, the way Esau used it in the parsha before where he said, "Yakveni, you underhanded me." No longer will people say you got the blessings in an underhanded way. I will announce to the world, "Yisrael, Yashar, above board, you did it by the light of day. I give you permission to have a new name." And he becomes Israel. And then Jacob asks, as we said, the angel, "What is your name, sir?" And he doesn't even say, "Well, I don't want to tell you." Or he doesn't even want to answer. He just basically ignores Jacob's question and says, Well, why is it that you ask for my name? He gives them the blessing of Israel. Goodbye. Let's look at source 3, 4, 5, and 6. Now, these are Rashi's, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchak's commentaries. Our rabbis explain in source 3 that this Ish, who wrestled and tried to destroy Jacob, was none other than the guardian angel, unsurprisingly, of Esau. Esau has a protective angel. Every nation of the world, except for the Jewish people, we don't have a protective angel. We have the direct protection of God. But every angel has sort of a nation, an ummah, that they look out for. So Esau had an angel that looks out for him. All right. And we already mentioned earlier, how do we know that it's something beyond human? Because how could Jacob both be alone and then a man finds him? Seems to be contradictory. So it can't be a flesh and blood man. It has to be something supernatural. For dawn is breaking, says the angel. And why do I have to leave? Very strange. I have to recite a song of praise. Really? I'll explore this in a moment. And then he says, I will let you go, Jacob says, providing you have blessed me. Acknowledge for me, Jacob says, that the blessings with which my father Isaac blessed me, which Esau is contesting, I want you to announce it to the world through my name change, that the blessings I got from dad are my blessings. It wasn't Biramaut. It wasn't a deception. Okay. And then the angel most strangely says in response, what's your name, Mr. Man? He says, well, why do you ask? So essentially, look at Rashi. We have no permanent name as an angel. Our names change, all according to the service we are commanded to do in the mission upon which we are sent. Strange. So let's unpackage a little bit of this story. Okay, so who is the angel? So that we have an answer for from source 3. He was the protector angel of Esau. Some identify him as the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. The Malach HaMavet, some identify him as the angel of death. He's not a happy guy, and we're not happy to see him. And he is the protector angel, not surprisingly, of wicked Esau, of Esau. Okay. And then he says, dawn is breaking, and I have to go sing a song of praise. So the rabbis extrapolate on this, but this always bothered me, and I'm going to share what I thought was an insight that I created, and my rabbi kind of took the steam out and said, no, he thought of it earlier, and it was probably thought of by many people earlier. Okay, here is what always bothered me. Okay. Angels have been around longer than humans. So the matter says that the angels are created before humanity. Adam is not created until the sixth day. The humans came many, many years after the creation of these celestial bodies known as angels. So every angel apparently has one unique morning where they are summoned, predestined, to sing songs of praise before God. Okay. So this angel has been around for a really long time. And I always found it a little coincidental, yeah, that the one morning after he challenges Jacob to the duel, the showdown at the OK Corral, that morning you have to leave because it happens to be your morning to sing praise, Mr. Angel? Like you had thousands and thousands of mornings, but it happens to be the one that is directly the morning after the wrestling match with Jacob. That's your only day ever. And there's no makeup. Apparently, if that angel misses his day, it's gone. Like that's his first opportunity to sing praises before God, to thank God for having created him. Isn't that kind of strange? It's like a plot twist that is highly problematic to me. I always found it too much of a coincidence to believe it. So I had an approach. You ready? Here's my approach. The angel did not have a predestined planned day to sing praise before God. Well, why would an angel sing praise? Because the angel has completed his mission. In other words, if every angel is given a shlichut, a mission, their emissary is for God, yeah? So it's their duty to fulfill their mission. When the mission is completed, or at least validated, then and only then they must immediately go back to Shemayim, to whatever that means, to God's presence, and sing praises to God because they have sort of completed their task. So I want you to think about this. If the angel is the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, the evil inclination, has been around since before man, and he's met every human being ever. And every human being he's ever met in some way, shape, or form, and this is not to diminish Adam, who we know had an issue with the tree of knowledge, and Noah, he had maybe some issues with the wine and whatever else. And unfortunately, it would include even Abraham and Isaac and Sarah and Rebecca. But until this angel had man-to-man combat with Jacob, he had never successfully completed his mission. You know why? Because no one ever bested him. He always won the day. Somehow, he won the day. This is the first moment in the life of the angel that someone beat him. Now, that means what? That God put the angel in a situation where he would constantly be challenging humans, tempting humans, put roadblocks and stumbling blocks in front of us. And we need those stumbling blocks to fulfill our potentiality of who we could be. So it's tough because sometimes we probably lose almost all the time. And some level, that Yetzer Hara, he knows our weaknesses because he's us. He's part of your soul. He knows the uniqueness of each Jewish soul. And he's there to tempt you. And so never had anyone successfully navigated this angel until he met Jacob. Jacob won. And in fact, the rabbis say when he hit his sciatic nerve and damaged him, he was in the groin area. He was trying to utilize knowledge that the angel had that some of the predestined offspring of Jacob would be less than righteous. And he was hoping that if Jacob was told that you're going to have children one day who are not going to be such great guys, that that would weaken the resolve of Jacob and he might lose. But Jacob was resolute and he refused to allow his powers to be weakened. So the angel is probing every part of the essence of who Jacob was, and he can find no place to attack Jacob. And all night long, the two are going back and forth until when the dawn breaks, the angel realizes, oh my gosh, I got to go now, pal. You're the first human being that ever mano a mano won against me. This is the first time. And my response to you winning, he clapped. I got to go sing to God and thank Hashem for having created you, Jacob. So I got to go. So that was my answer, right? So when my rabbi, when I heard this, he said, David, he said, it's nice, but pshat, that's a simple explanation. He deflated my ego in a very big way. But it's still a valid approach, okay? So what it means, and I think it's revolutionary, and it will help answer the other questions, is that why does God create this Yetzer Hara, this evil inclination? The evil inclination exists clearly to allow us to have freedom of choice. The greater you are and the greater your resolve is in this world, the greater the Yetzer Hara has to be in order to make it equal for you. In other words, if you're Yetzer Hara, if you're a great, righteous, pious person and you're not tempted by anything, then by you choosing good over evil, it's not so consequential. Correct? But if you are a more pious individual, the more piety you have. So if you're Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva's Yetzer Hara would be mountainous. It would be huge because it's got to make an equal playing field, or Rabbi Akiva will never get credit for anything he does good. People will say, well, Rabbi Akiva, you were so pious. Your little 2-pound Yetzer Hara could never win the day. So he has to have Andre the Giant as his Yetzer Hara. Right? And then he can triumph and get some credit for his good actions. Yeah? So with Jacob is asking the angel, okay, I won the day against Yetzer Hara. I want to know your name. Now, are they playing games here? Because he doesn't answer the question. He says, why do you ask for my name? Yeah? And then he leaves. What was he asking? So the word for name in Hebrew is shem. Name. Ma shimcha. What is your name? or in Israel they'll call Eich Korim Lecha. What do they call you? Yeah? The word shame, name, comes from the word place. Sham. You're over there. It's the essence of you, and I. Whatever you are, it's based on your name. So when Adam famously named all the creatures that God created and came up with his own name and even came up with a name for Hashem, the angels were in awe of Adam because that was something beyond the angels. Because for Adam to see an animal and to see the essence of what made that animal tick was something that the angels were just not capable of. Whereas a human has the ability to reach into the essence of a human being. So a name defines you. So what was Jacob actually asking the angel? I want to know, because I won. But what recipe can I give to my children? The B'nai Yisrael, the children of Jacob. What message can I give them? I want to identify you, my friend. And if I give them your name, they will be able to understand what makes you tick. And if they know what makes you tick, Mr. Angel, they will actually know how to defeat you in battle. And the angel says, sorry, I don't have any name. One second.
Could we close the door here, please?
Could we close the door, please, Mom?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just don't want the tape to have voices in the background. They'll be saying, maybe the angels are distracting you. Could be. Angels in the outfield. So here is the essence. Jacob says, I want to know who you are. What's your name? And if I know your name, then I can tell my children, this is what he is called, and this is how to fight him. And what does the angel say? Remember what he said in number 6? Why is it that you ask? We have no permanent name. Our names change all according to the service we are commanded to do. That wasn't a lie. He's saying that our angel status is dependent upon the mission we go on. So, for example, if there is a generic angel going to do healing, he becomes Raphael, the angel of healing. If the angel's going to do some mighty feat, maybe he'll become Gabriel. That's one possibility of what he was saying. But the other possibility, which is kind of frightening, I believe this to be true. The Yetzirah, the evil inclination, is saying, I morph into whatever my needs are at the moment. In other words, every one of us has a Yetzirah, has a unique dark side that is yours and yours alone. We all have our demons that we wrestle with that are ours. So maybe I love food, but the other person, they don't have an issue with food. Maybe they have an issue with, pick your choice. And then someone else. So everybody has their weaknesses. And the angel of death, or this Malach HaMavis, / the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, has to be in tune with each of us. So he's telling Jacob, I'm sorry, it's not so easy. I can't tell you a name because I don't really have a name. A name would imply that this is who I am. This is my essence. Guess what? I don't have an essence. I'm malleable in a bad way for you. Meaning, and this is really true, when we fight our own demons, let's say, please God, you take your worst demon and you wipe him out. Have you ever noticed that as soon as you wipe out one demon, somehow it morphs and you have something else that you deal with? And if you successfully navigate that second issue, all of a sudden, number 3 pops up, right? So you'll get a person who goes, well, I'll just pick something here random, okay? Let's say a person has cigarettes, nicotine, one of the toughest things to deal with, right? And as soon as they conquer, please God, their nicotine habit, all of a sudden they might have, oh my gosh, that was an appetite suppressant. So all of a sudden they put on 150 pounds because they no longer have the cigarettes helping to suppress the, right? So you understand the idea that you go from demon to demon. Yetzirah morphs. And therefore when Jacob says, I won, but I want to give an antidote. So I want to know your name. I want to know your essence. And the angel says, sorry, it can't work that way. And in fact, if you think about it, if we had no Yetzirah, no evil inclination tempting us, then what would we, our free will would be in imbalance. Your free will would be meaningless because what are you combating? In other words, if there isn't a defined option, if I can't choose freely to do sin, whatever that sin is, then my performance of a mitzvah, of a good deed, it's not that consequential because I'm more like a robot. I'm a computer program that God hardwired. I don't really have a choice. So I believe that that might be also one of the little things going on here with the angels. So let's just back up for a moment, summarize, and I'll give you something to think about going away. So we discovered that angels are, in fact, emissaries of God, but they're not like the Christological style angels that we've talked about. They're really represent, whatever that means, I don't really know what they mean. It doesn't mean they're a defined being. And in fact, there is a possibility. There are rabbis who say that Jacob fought with himself that night. There wasn't anyone else. And that makes a lot of sense if you think about it. Because if it says Jacob was left alone, there was a movie called Star Wars. And I'm thinking the second Star... I'm always going back to Star Wars, I apologize. In the second Star Wars movie, Luke Skywalker has a famous dream and he's fighting. And he ends up stabbing himself with his own lightsaber. But he ends up fighting, and he doesn't know this, Darth Vader, who is himself. The Darth Vader is the dark side. He doesn't know that Darth Vader is his father. So he has to fight himself and he ends up stabbing himself. So it's entirely possible, according to one approach of the rabbis, that Jacob is fighting the Esau, the latent Esau manifestations. Remember, Esau and Jacob share a womb. They share genetics, everything they share, nurture, nature, the whole thing. So it's not improbable that perhaps Jacob had certain things within him that were Esau-like that he had to subdue. And perhaps that night, in preparation to meet the man, the flesh and blood human being, Esau, that he would meet the next day, he has to make sure that he's prepared by attacking the spiritual part of Esau that perhaps is dormant within the confines of Jacob's soul. And perhaps that's why he had to fight that night, but he's really an internal battle that's going on. That is possible. That is an absolutely possible message. So what's the good message to go from here? The message is, and I think it's kind of interesting, that the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, will only get punished by God if he overdoes it, if he gives us too much of a stumbling block in our lives. But he was put on this earth to give us reward for obeying God in the Torah. In other words, the ultimate job, and you get that feeling, the idea that this angel has to go back to heaven to praise God for having created Jacob who beat him, who bested him in battle, that's an unbelievable idea. That the angel, in other words, yes, he's adversarial, but that's his mission. I'm sure when they go to angel school and they're giving out the roles, okay, who wants to be the angel of healing? You know, all the hands in the back of the classroom go up. Who wants to be the angel of death? Most hated guy. Any Satan guys here? And I imagine the hands in the angel room are not going up very much, right? It's not a gig we want. But as long as he doesn't overdo it, the angel has a purpose to challenge us. And if we are like Jacob, and if we have the resolve that Jacob has, we can overcome the angel. We can get incredible reward in this world, and we can understand the adversary. So my blessing for all of us is that as we live out our lives, we now have a little bit of a different perspective, I believe, on angels. And lastly, let me just give you one last thought. Remember I asked a question? You probably forgot that I asked this, but I didn't. I asked you, how crazy is it that Jacob separated himself from the familial power of his family to be alone across that little river for some inconsequential knickknacks? Remember I asked that question? It's crazy. Like, why would he subject himself to danger over some little things that weren't even precious enough to bring along the first time? So the rabbis say that those pachim ketanim, those little things, were the most valuable thing that Jacob had in his life. Now think about it. We all have been there. It's sad. If you've ever had to go to a home after someone passed away, could have been a parent, could have been a grandparent. The little knickknacks that Jacob had forgotten on the first trip but he went back for are those little things that made your Zadie or your Bubby or your parents your parent. They weren't eBay objectively valuable to the rest of the world, but they were little keepsakes and little things that made your dad your mom, your Zadie. Those things are the investment that we make in this world. And at the end of the day, what is there other than the children that we leave, our good name that we leave, the kindness that we did in our world, and the investment that we made in God's world? And there's a whole holiday coming up that we'll speak more about in the future called Hanukkah, which is all about investment of lighting. It's not so much the quantity of what you light, the fact that you light. The rabbis say that one of the objects that he found was a little jar, and he brought it back. And that jar, whether literally or metaphorically, was the jar that the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, found unbroken, the sealed pure olive oil. It doesn't mean it's a literal. It just means it's a representation. That was the miracle of Hanukkah through that little pach, that little jar. And so I believe, and I mentioned this to Rachel, this is something I never thought of before until this moment, the angel did not coincidentally attack Jacob just because he's alone. He had to prevent him from showing us what is important in life. And so the moment he attacks him, it's specifically because Jacob goes back, shows his understanding that the things that matter in the world are the investments, these little pachim betanim. And it's at that moment when Jacob's alone going back for the little knickknacks that the angel says, I can't have that. I have to destroy this man. I cannot have him teaching the Jewish people, the Israelites, that this is the most important thing in the world, what you invest in this world. And so at that moment, the angel comes to destroy Jacob because he will not tolerate Jacob going back for the little things in life. So I ask you, if an angel of death is willing to be hell-bent on destroying Jacob at any cost, to destroy him because he sees what really matters in this world, the things we invest in, maybe that's where we should focus our priorities. Because if the angel of death doesn't want us doing that, that's probably a good signal to us that that's where we should apply ourselves. So my prayer for all of us, this Hanukkah coming up, and we should all invest and continue to invest in yourselves, in your families, in our community, in your community, and of course, for the Jewish people everywhere. Thank you, everyone.